Welcome to the October call. I particularly want to say welcome to those of you who are in brand new chapters. In the first 3 years of Citizens Climate Lobby from 2007, 2008, and 2009, we had a total of 12 chapters. Between last month's call and this month's call, we added 18 chapters. So more chapters over the course of the last month than we had the first 3 years. So particularly welcome to those of you who are new. It's great to have you aboard. I hope you find this to be a really nice home like it's been for a lot of us. If you are new, what's going to happen is in just a moment, I'm going to be introducing our guest who we're very excited to have, who had the highest rated breakout session at our international conference in June. We'll be going over some results that have happened since last month, talking about what we're going to be doing this month. And then I think I have some news at the very end of the call to tell you what to look forward to that we'll be reporting at November Educational Day at that very end of the call. So let me just give you a little teaser. I'm kind of excited about some of the stuff at the very end. Barbara Love, our speaker, is pretty familiar with the organization. You know, she's spoken at our conference and she knows a lot of our volunteers. But there's one thing that I want to tell you, Barbara, about these people is their extraordinary persistence. On September 16th of last month, the newspaper in Flagstaff, which a lot of our groups meet with editorial boards, Flagstaff does not hold editorial board meetings, so they had to have this published simply by the newspaper observing what they were doing. So the Flagstaff paper's title was Bipartisan Carbon Taxes No Longer Pie in the Sky. This is the newspaper taking a position. They call it a tax, that's fine. They opened by saying, we have to hand it to the Citizens Climate Lobby. When they didn't succeed in getting a series of Flagstaff city councils to support a carbon tax, they kept coming back. Because we met with the city council last year and they turned us down. They said they weren't going to endorse fee and dividend. This year, the carbon tax received unanimous support even from the council's free market conservatives. This is the newspaper continuing. A carbon tax is the closest thing to a bipartisan fix as the global warming debate will find. They go on to say one former Harvard economist, former skeptic Greg Mankiw is now on board, and other factors like major oil companies like ExxonMobil being on board. And then they conclude the article by talking about all the times that people bring issues to the city council that they don't support. And they said what distinguished Citizens Climate Lobby is they did their homework and kept coming back. So the people that you're talking to are the most persistent, relentless people I've ever met. It reminds me a lot of that famous Wallace Stevens quote, after the final no, there comes a yes. And on that yes, the future of the world depends. Okay, our guest today. Barbara Love, Professor Emeritus, UMass Amherst. Now, Barbara asked me the opposite of what most people do. Usually people send me several pages about them and say, make sure and tell them all these things. Barbara said, please tell as little as possible the introduction. I want as much time to speak as possible. So she is recognized globally for her work on organizational and societal transformation and on issues of diversity, inclusion, and liberation. And Barbara Love, thank you so much. I know you're at a conference, so you had to step away from what you're doing. Thank you for stepping away so you could join us, and welcome.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be here, and I'm delighted to be amongst a group of people who are that persistent. So thank you for what you do. I'm going to talk to you today about building relationships across race and culture. You are committed to creating the conditions so that legislation or actions can be taken to save this planet, to get to the point, plain and simple. And in order to do that, you need and you are committed to building broad-based coalitions. So I'm going to talk about one of the things that can help you as you think about building those broad-based coalitions. Specifically, how do you make relationships and sustain relationships with people from a variety of races, cultures, and backgrounds? Now, I'm going to use the term people of the global majority in my comments, and this is a term that might be new to some of you, so I want to explain why I use the term people of the global majority. Are you still with me, Ricky, on the slides? I use the term people of the global majority instead of the term that you may be familiar with, people of color, to refer to that collection of African heritage, Asian heritage, Native American, Latina peoples. Next slide, Ricky. This collection of people we have typically referred to, next slide, as people of color, and I use the term people of the global majority. Next slide. I use that term because, next slide. Okay, I use that term because this collection of people represent over 90% of the world's population. And so this is an accurate description of who this collection of people are. Europeans represent just about 9.94% of the world's population. Next slide. So this says 9 strategies, so I've sent you the wrong one. In another iteration, when I have a lot more time, I will tell you 9 strategies. Today, I'm going to tell you only 5. So first of all, obviously, you need to, if you're going to build coalitions with people from a variety of backgrounds, you need to seek those people out. You need to seek parity engagements, but I'm going to talk about the next one, which is mind your manners. You need to be prepared to make mistakes. You need to interrupt patterns of invisibility and not expect people of the global majority to service you. So, next slide, and it seems that I wonder how many people of the global majority are actually in this meeting. Does anybody have any, are there any people of the global majority in those groups? I'm asking because if there aren't, I'm going to skip over the comments that I would typically share with people of the global majority, because as I give these guidelines, I give one set of rules for white people and a different set of rules for people of the global majority. And if there aren't people of the global majority on the call, then I can save that time and use all of that time to talk with white people. So unless somebody
there are people, so yes.
Okay, so I will then talk both to white people as well as to people of the global majority. I'm going to, if I talk too fast because I want to say more than my time is available, Mark, you'll have to slow me down. First of all, you're going to have to find white people. You're going to have to find people of the global majority and make relationships with them. You're going to have to abandon just meeting with people with whom you are familiar or with people with whom you are comfortable. And if people say, are you meeting with me just because, or are you trying to make friendships with me just because I'm a person of the global majority, you're going to have to say yes. You're going to have to say, I have been kept from meeting with you or making friendships or relationships or being around you because you were people of the global majority. And so now I'm going to have to pay attention to the fact that you are a person of the global majority that I want to be in relationship with and say, yes, will you agree to be my friend? Will you agree to have this conversation with me? Now, I have to say to people of the global majority, you get to say yes and you get to say no, and you get to choose when and with whom you want to be in relationship with. And you get to have the relationships with white people on terms that work for you. One of the key terms that makes relationships work is that you demand authenticity. And remember that this goal of protecting the environment, of saving the environment, is in your best interest too. So next slide. Go on to the next slide because I'm saving my time. Yes. Look for long-term commitments. Aim for long-term relationships and be prepared to stay there in the face of discomfort. Be prepared for differences in lifestyles and values and beliefs. Be prepared to develop relationships with people on terms that are different than that you are familiar with. And for people of the global majority, as you enter into these relationships, create parameters that work for you. When race complicates issues and in relationships with people across racial boundaries, race will always be a factor. You need to be prepared to talk about it. You need to be able to raise that when it becomes an issue. And you need to be able to require white people that you are in relationships with to be able to have those conversations with you, even when they are difficult conversations. The temptation in the past has been to assimilate or to acculturate or to try to be more like the organization, but part of the point in having relationships across difference is to bring those points of difference into the relationship. And so if you give up being who you are so that you can be in the relationship, you lose part of the value of having relationships across difference. Find shared interests and make those commitments real. Next slide. Go on to the next slide. I'll come back to that if we have more time. Mind your manners. So, guidelines for white people, get the names right. Often, people of the global majority will have names that are not easy on your tongue. And white people often will have a tendency to try to make it easy on themselves by giving a person of the global majority a nickname. Not okay. They will sometimes ask, is it okay if I just call you, I'll just say, for example, Susie? No, it's not okay to call them Susie. Keep asking them to say the name until you get it right, and then go home and practice. Practice until it comes easier off your tongue. And a couple of other things. Don't tell the person of the global majority that you're in a relationship with or developing a relationship with about all your other PGM friends, people of the global majority. Don't tell one person of the global majority about your nanny who raised you, or don't tell them about your long lost friend that you had when you were in second grade that you're no longer in touch with and how sad you are. Put your focus on present time, on the person of the global majority that you are working on developing a relationship right now. And don't talk about the history and the culture of the person of the global majority that you knew once. Talk about what history you're going to make with the person of the global majority that you're seeking to be in a relationship right now. Now, people of the global majority, it's okay to help them get your name right. And don't say, yes, it's okay to a nickname that they want to give you. Avoid the urge to make it easy by allowing them to shorten your name, or I had to say to someone the other day, no, it's not okay to just keep calling me Barb. My name is Barbara. I like being called Barbara. Take the time to say Barbara. Barb is not acceptable. And people of the global majority, interrupt white people when they mistake you for another person of the global majority. And it's okay to do that. It's okay to say, no, I'm Barbara. And that's Gloria that you're thinking about. And Gloria is, if you want to say something about Gloria, but distinguish yourself and claim you. You can interrupt white people when they want to tell you about their friends who are people of the global majority. It's an interesting thing, but that's not what we are about right here. And it's okay to educate white people about your history and about the experiences of your people. And yes, we do have a general guideline that it's not the job of people of the global majority to educate white people. And yes, we do get to respect that guideline. And in the final analysis, if you don't give them the information, who will? And since it's your relationship too, you get to be in charge of making it a relationship that works. And part of it is giving people the information, giving white people the information that they need to be in a relationship of authenticity with you. Next slide. White people, be prepared to make mistakes. Don't assume that after all this time and in this country and in this cultural context, that you can develop relationships of authenticity with people of the global majority without making mistakes. Because if you stay worried about making mistakes, there's one thing for sure, and that is that you won't do it. Because you can't do it without making mistakes. And if you're worried about making mistakes, then that means you're going to draw back, you're going to hold back, and you're not going to engage. Is that a signal? That's my time. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up by saying, three things. Acknowledge the mistake, clean it up, ask the person of the global majority what they need to do to clean it up, and people of the global majority, you get to say, that was a mistake, and here's what we need to do to clean it up. I leave you with a homework assignment, and that is, spend some time talking to another person about your relationships across race and cultural backgrounds, and invite that person to let you listen to them do the same. The more you can take time to do that exercise, the easier it will be for you to actually engage in relationships with people who are different from you across race and cultural background. Thank you so much, and I think we have time for some questions, I hope.
That in almost every briefing call with every speaker, we ask them to do a 12-minute introduction so that we can take as much time for questions and answers. And you're the first one that actually came in that time. So thank you for that.
All right.
So we're gonna open up questions in the chat, and Ricky will monitor. And I also want to say, part of what is so fascinating to me about what you said is it's so much that what we've tried to train ourselves on, but it's mostly been the tension between Republicans and Democrats. We've mostly tried to find commonality across that gap, and also, you know, tried to encourage people, as you said, to take big chances, because otherwise, you know, if we're not willing to make mistakes, we're not going to get anywhere with people, and we can't be afraid of that. Yeah. So it's absolutely fascinating. So Ricky, can you just monitor the chat and tell me if there are things that people are asking so far that that we'd like Barbara to expand upon? Can you just give me a second here, Barbara?
Yeah, I'm checking the chat for you. Nothing okay. right now.
Okay, good. Well, while we're waiting for that, anything that you want to elaborate on what you covered so far, because you did do that with an enormous amount of velocity, which I appreciated.
Yes, I think I went rather fast. And no, I was just, we can hold off and see if there are questions. If there aren't questions, I'll see if there's another point on that list that I will talk about.
Okay, somebody asked what the fifth point was. Maybe that one didn't come across when you were covering the points.
I'm not sure. It might have been not interrupting, about interrupting patterns of racism. So I might not have talked about that. And so for white people, assume that there will be patterns of racism because they have been installed on all of us. None of us have escaped because we have been raised and socialized in a society characterized by racism. Not be surprised when it happens. Not be afraid when it happens. Not get worried when it happens, simply acknowledge it, name it, interrupt it, and figure out what to do about it in collaboration with the person of the global majority toward whom the pattern of racism has been targeted. And people of the global majority, you get to notice it, you get to name it, you get to avoid worrying about whether or not the person's gonna accuse you of being overly sensitive or having a chip on your shoulder. Or sometimes when people identify patterns of behavior or language that reflect race, will be accused of playing the race card. Well, you can't play the race card now. It's in play. It has been in play for these last several hundred years. And what we get to do now is to notice it, name it, and figure out what to do about it. And to have the confidence in each other and in the relationship that you are building to know that it's something that we can manage. It's something that we can talk about. It's something that we can go through together and come out the other side of that conversation stronger, with a more authentic relationship, and with a relationship that is more capable of doing the work that we want done.
Great. Okay, and Ricky, I've noticed that the chat's been a little bit going crazy now. Can you pick a couple of things that you think would be good for Barbara to address?
Sure, yeah. The first question comes from Steve, and he says, my friends of the global majority, which I don't know if anybody was using that term before this call, so I love it. My friends of the global majority will tell me that climate is my issue, is Steve's issue, but they're more concerned about race issues. How do you think we should respond to something like that?
Oh, that's such a good question, and it's such an important one. And I like to remind people of the global majority that I'm talking to that when the radiation left Three Mile Island, it didn't skip over the black community. And when the temperature gets too hot on Earth, it's not going to get too hot just for white people. Maintaining this planet with an inhabitable climate is going to be for everybody. And so it doesn't matter whether we address issues of race if we have no climate in which to address it. So you get to remind them of the reality that we all breathe the same air. And even though healthcare differs by zip code, schooling differs by zip code, housing differs by zip code, when the air becomes unbreathable, it's going to cross zip codes. It's going to cross neighborhoods, and it affects him too. It affects them too. So they get to think about whether or not the future that they are imagining can happen in a climate that doesn't work.
Great.
Great.
You know, there's a couple of questions along this theme of what would you suggest or ways that we can organize ourselves to help reach out and establish relationships with people the global majority, and maybe different organizations. So what are some things that we could be doing to achieve that?
In the end, developing these relationships is going to be a person-by-person individual matter. And connecting with organizations can give you access and opportunities that you might not otherwise have. But in the end, assume that it's going to be because individual people reach out to make individual relationships and get commitments from individuals to be in those relationships. In my opinion, that is going to work best. So it means that while you might try to find organizations with whom you have or seek to make common cause, probably it's going to mean putting yourself individually in unfamiliar places, maybe uncomfortable places and spaces, and talking with people with whom you aren't accustomed to talking or might not be comfortable talking with. Everything in the end is about relationships, and organizationally you might seek to make those relationships, but individuals are going to have to make the reach.
Great.
Yeah, Ricky, I want to add one. Yeah, we do have one time for another question, but I want to just add one point to what Barbara said. You know, I read an interview with Cesar Chavez one time, and they asked him what was the key to his organizing, what was the magic, you know, because clearly he was doing something nobody had ever done. He said, I talked to one person, and when I'm done talking to that person, I talk to the next person. And then I said, no, really, what's the key though? What's the trick? And he said, I talked to one person. When I'm done talking to that one person, I talk to the next person.
There you go. Yeah. And there's no substitute for it.
Nope. Ricky, great. Next question, please.
Yeah, so a couple of folks, Barbara, I guess want you to sort of expand on the idea of a common mistake and maybe give like a concrete example of a common mistake that either side would make, but probably from, towards the people of the global majority and how we could resolve that mistake.
A common mistake, it's hard to think immediately of a common mistake. I mentioned a couple, not getting the names right, wanting to shorten the name, wanting to tell about, one of the easy mistakes that white people make is wanting to tell you about their other black friends or their other Asian friends or their other friends of that group, or wanting to tell you about their early experiences with somebody in that group, as opposed to focusing on this person in front of you, this relationship, and what history we could build together. So there are three very common mistakes, almost so common that you don't notice that that's not exactly the thing to do if you're wanting to build a relationship with someone. People of the global majority usually flinch when it happens, but very often won't say something. So you might not know that that's a mistake. So don't start out the conversation telling me or asking me about, I know this black person in Milwaukee. Do you know them? There are a lot of black people in Milwaukee, and the chances, even though the degrees of separation are fairly short, 2 to 1, don't assume that I might know this person just because they are black. Oh, and the other common easy mistake is to mistake a person for someone else of that group, and to assume that this is that person rather than learning to distinguish between those people.
Great. All right. Well, now I can see why I read all these extraordinary comments about your talk that you gave at the June conference. Thank you again for that. I do read through everybody's evaluation for the conference, and it was just everything jumped out from your session. And I know you're at a conference and that you'd take time to jump out and speak with us. We're extremely grateful. We're really interested in developing ourselves, and this is really helpful in allowing us to continue to push ourselves up against our comfort zones, go beyond that, and hopefully build broader coalitions.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on the work you're doing. Thank you for letting me be a part of your journey for this time, and carry on.
Great. Thank you so much. And you're welcome to stay on for the next 10 or 15 minutes if you want, or if you have to get back.
I'll go back to the conference. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Okay, great. Yeah, for those of you who are interested in expanding on this discussion, I really think that there's a couple of our action teams that would be well-suited to expand this conversation. the climate and environmental justice action team, and then also our Spanish language team. So if you're interested in working directly in this area, both of those groups are regularly doing that. And so you could certainly join those action teams that you can find access to on Community. I'll give you a few updates on some really interesting things that happened in the last month. It's not unusual for us to have a particular month in print media where we get a lot of letters to the editor. Or it's not unusual that occasionally we'll get a lot of op-eds. So for instance, during April, on Earth Day, it's not unusual for us to get, you know, 50, 60, 70 op-eds. And occasionally there's a month where we get a lot of editorials. But it never happens that in all three cases, something remarkable happens. But it did this month. So for instance, we had 348 letters to the editor, 80 op-eds, and 35 editorials. We've never had a month where across the board, print media in every single pay area, it just jumped off the table. So for everybody who submitted something, absolutely extraordinary work, just completely mind-blowing. We had 68 endorsements this month. And in addition to the city of Flagstaff that I mentioned in the opening editorial, there were five municipalities. So for people who are reaching out to local officials, that's really great. We should always remind ourselves that what got Carlos Curbelo to be the Republican co-chair of the Climate Solutions Caucus was getting local leaders coming to see him in his office, showing that, yes, there was local support. This work is important and really remarkable what's getting done. In addition to the endorsements here, Canada has been working on an online tool where people endorse what we're doing, and the Canadians got the City of Toronto to sign on this month. So for Cheryl, Tom, everybody who was involved on that getting Toronto on our online letter is absolutely remarkable. I mentioned that we started 18 chapters since last month's call, which was more than the first 3 years. The most chapters we have ever started in a year is 82. We've started 91 so far this year. So for everybody who's involved in making that happen, who trained themselves to lead the program, who did the outreach for the local organizers, more chapters started this year than we've ever had in a year, and we've still got 3 months to go. Our regional conferences have started. So right now, the North Winds are meeting as we speak, our first kickoff of regional conference. I'm sure it's warmer than it was last year because last year was freezing. I was happy to be there last year, but it was really cold. The Great Lakes is coming up soon. We have a New Mexico State Conference that I'll be connecting in by Zoom. And then the conference in Phoenix, the first weekend of November, I'll be joining you there in Phoenix. I look forward to seeing all of you there. Our speaker in November is Major General Devereaux. And, you know, we're excited for a lot of reasons, including that it's so great to have someone from the military on Veterans Day. So our November call, which is on Veterans Day, is going to have Major General Devereaux, and we're very, very excited about that. I want to go over what we're going to be doing in Canada and the U.S., and then I want to talk just a touch about some of the things that are interesting for Congressional Education Day. So in Canada, we're going to continue what we have been working on, which is trying to get more NGOs, businesses, cities on our online letter, and then also doing all the work that we need to get ready for our conference in Ottawa. So it's mostly continuing to keep up what we've been doing over several months. The momentum building on both of those is really, really solid. In the U.S., we're going to ask you to outreach to locally elected politicians, especially local elected Republicans. So what we want to do is continue to make sure that our members know back home in district, there's very good tools on the action sheet for doing this, that back home in district, there's going to be support for them when they take courageous action on DC. And then we're going to do, you know, lots of times we've done a call-in day before the June conference or November Education Day, but we've done it the day before we go on the Hill. One of the organizations we work with, the Congressional Management Foundation, that all they do is study what works with Congress, they've told us that if we do that a little bit earlier, it makes a bigger difference, so we're going to move that up. And again, all the tools will be there. There's two laser talks, and I recommend that you practice or study both of them. One of them is about the dividend delivery. This is important for a lot of reasons, including which over the last 3 years, it's ranked as either first, second, or third most important issue the congressional offices bring up that they want us to talk about. And after November Education Day, we're going to be inviting members of the House and Senate to briefings on the dividend. So the more familiar we are with that, the better. The other is about the climate effects of hurricanes. I think when there's big events like this, we have to be very rigorous and careful about how we talk about things. I don't think you can find anything in the scientific literature that says we'll have more hurricanes, but you can find plenty in the scientific literature that says that the severity of them, because of warmer oceans and a lot of other factors, that we should expect increased severity. So please make sure you're studying that. Okay, last thing, Congressional Education Day. The most people we've ever had come to one of those is 289 people. There are 416 people who've registered for November so far. 397 people have signed up to book appointments. 141 of those are already booked. 34 of those are what we call face-to-face. Face-to-face means we're meeting with actual member of the House or Senate, not just staff. Oftentimes staff meetings are more important than members, but getting to the members is also absolutely crucial. One of the things that we try and measure that is without doubt the hardest thing that we measure from June every year is the tone of Republican meetings. Are they engaged? Are they asking questions that indicate a high degree of interest, or are they in some way dismissive or non-responsive? So 3 years ago when we started measuring this, it looked from the meeting notes that for every three good meetings, we had one where the Republican office wasn't that interested. The next year, it was a 6-to-1 ratio. So six good meetings for one where it didn't look like it was going so well. Last year, it was a 10-to-1 ratio. So for every meeting with a Republican that we didn't think went so well, 10 went really well. This year, that is 20-to-1. So for every meeting that we have with a Republican office, 20 of them are engaged, asking good questions, and interested versus one being uninterested. You know, we've been ranking members of Congress and they're interested in engaging on climate change since we've been doing this. If one was the lowest and four was the highest, we only have 11 offices in the House and Senate that still rank a one. So your job of moving people up the scale of engagement has been remarkably successful. In previous years, the percentage of meetings with members of the House and Senate that were face-to-face was 9%. This year, it was 28%. So there's something that you're doing with the offices where those staff members say to themselves, I want these people meeting with my member of Congress. In Republican offices alone, for all the Republican meetings, 25% of them were face-to-face with a member of Congress. So there's a lot more data we'll be reporting. We'll be training people on this in advance of when we go on the Hill in November. After we get that out in front of all the people who are coming to Congressional Education Day, we'll get it out to everybody. There's a lot of really good, really interesting news, and we're simply the only organization that can provide this to Congress. We're the only organization that can come and say, we met with almost everybody in the House and Senate. We've compiled the data. We can show you how that compares to previous years. Here's what you can know about where you are about responding to the dividend. So I guess my message is this. What you're doing is working. Please keep it up. All right, Ricky, you can unmute everybody. Thank you all so much. We'll see you in November with Deborah.
Say goodbye, everybody. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is all over.
Again,
yeah,
most important. He was spinning it in a way that I didn't feel bad about. I mean, at least they're here.
Anyway, you've got about 1 minute.
Hey, it's Amy.
So I went in there a month ago to ask for a donation of pacers. And the son was in there. No problem. He understood. When I went back to get him, he wasn't there.